Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 233. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me today, John Lindemann.
I'm back, bitches.
Yes, he is. James Jones.
Hello.
And Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, hoy, everyone.
Yep, we've got a very exciting show for you today. Of course, John's back from his absence last week, so we're going to catch up with him and all the games. He's been playing so many games.
I got games, baby.
Games and games and games and games, including some Wii games.
Yep, believe
it. And James has a report on the brand new DS RPG Radiant Historia. I got some Virtual Console action for you, and then Greg is going to catch up with a former Retroactive nominee.
Johnny just spoiled the entire show.
Yeah. And then after a quick break, we have a whole bunch of listener mail. We're going to get through it as much of it as we can, so stay tuned for that. First up is new business, and John, since you were gone last week, I figured we'd start with you.
All right, before we get to the Wii stuff, of course, this week, the release of Killzone 3. Killzone, near and dear to my heart.
Bullet eating.
For the story. For the incredible character development that goes on. Yeah, so picked it up, and I have the... Finally, I got to put some time in with my Move controllers on a game that actually wasn't Little Big Planet.
This is interesting, though, John, because you're a proponent of The Conduit, and you've played... GoldenEye.
Is that what I am?
This is really interesting to me, though, because if you're playing Killzone 3 with Move, that's very analogous to playing a first-person shooter on the Wii with the pointer. So how would you compare it?
It's pretty much what you would expect. I mean, it's a little bit better than playing with the Wii remote. And just I think it's more. It has probably less to do with the controllers and more to do with the horsepower of the console. You know, it's still the same kind of control scheme where you have a configurable bounding box, and depending on, you know, when you hit the edge of that bounding box, you move over to the left or right or wherever you look.
Do you think you'll continue playing? I mean, assuming you're mainly using this for the campaign, right?
Yes.
Do you think you'll finish it that way, or are you going to flip back to the DualShock?
I don't know. The jury is still out because I'm really not too sure whether or not I'll be able to react quickly to somebody attacking me, like up close. Especially, well, the thing is that the melee controls are mapped very predictably to, you know, a forward thrust, right?
Hey now.
At least that should be more dependable than on Wii, because it does it not detect that through that glowing ball on the front as it gets closer to the camera? It knows that the move has been thrust forward. Whereas with Wii, as we've kind of talked about before, it's not all that good at knowing that.
Yeah.
Well, see, the move isn't really set up all that well for depth perception through the camera because it is a single camera.
Yeah, it's not like it's not binocular like Kinect, but just the fact that it has the glowing ball, if that gets bigger in its vision, it understands that it's getting closer to the camera.
Yeah, but the thing is, the move also has, of course, it has an accelerometer like the Wii, but it also has a magnetometer. Mm-hmm. And it has gyroscopes like Wii Motion Plus, but the magnetometer is primarily for detecting orientation with respect to the floor. And so I think that frees up their accelerometer to be a little more focused on the actual movement of the controller. And so maybe it helps with that. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I mean, whether or not it's the kind of thing where it's very hard to judge whether or not it's more accurate because it's just a very simple, you kind of like
gesture.
You just throw your arm forward. I mean, it's not. But that's the whole thing. I mean, it's sometimes hard, like, because they have, like, in some of the levels, they have enemies that specifically run at you, and they try to stab you.
In the face?
Yep. And so, you know, you can shoot them, but they're pretty much the ones where you know, you have to punch them. And of course, you know, they have the extra violent melee attack, you know, where you stab somebody in the eye or poke somebody's eyes out with your thumbs and stuff like that.
So here's the question, John. When you're stabbing someone in the eyes or gouging out their eyes with your thumbs, do you say anything?
I have a confession here, actually. When I beat, especially if I'm playing like an arcade style game like Mega Man, like an old school retro type game, and it has a boss. This is especially true for specifically Mega Man. Every time I ever beat a Mega Man boss, I say biatch at the end. I've done it for years. It just comes out. I don't even think about
it. Take that, Heat Man.
I'm all alone in my apartment, and I beat this boss, and it's just like a cry of glory. You know, it's a victory shout. A lot of times I say it under my breath, you know, like I just... It's just reflex.
Well, I try to keep Killzone on theme and say like, you know, I punch somebody's eyes out with my thumbs. I'm like, eat my thumbs, or, you know, eat my knife, or, you know, something like that. So I keep it on
you
theme.
Are a character in Bulletstorm.
I really
my
am.
My God. Eat my knife.
Well, let's see it now. Where it is better than the Wii Remote controls, and you know the Wii Remote nunchuck configuration is, there are just simply so many more buttons. You know,
yeah.
I mean, it really does actually, you know, approximate what you're doing with a normal DualShock controller. You kind of, and you don't realize it right away, but you can actually do several things at once. Like you'll be crouching, shooting at an enemy, and you know you twist the I don't even know what they call it, the
sub control.
Yeah. Yeah, they have some super complicated name for it, but you know, you twist that so you can be aiming at an enemy, and while you're doing that, like crouching, moving left or right, and also, you know, reloading your gun. You can do just a lot of stuff at once, and as you get more adept at using it, it actually becomes a pretty smooth playing experience. So, you know, kind of as I'm going on in the game, I'm like, you know what, this actually works. It's pretty good. But you know, I mean, it's not going to change the world. As for the game, it's Killzone. It's not going to make you love Killzone if you didn't like it before.
But it will, because jetpacks.
Yeah, jetpacks. That's the thing. I haven't run into that yet in the campaign.
It's in the demo. I played the single-player demo this week.
Yeah.
And it's in there, thank goodness.
Yeah, I played that too.
That's the one thing I wanted to be in the demo, and it's in there, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
It's a lot more fun than the one in Halo Reach, I have to say.
Yep. I think they probably use it more than they do in Reach as well.
I hope so.
In Reach is kind of, you kind of use it sometimes, but the thing is, I mean, especially in multiplayer, when you use the jetpack in Reach, you just become a big target.
That'll probably happen in Killzone too, but they give you a gun, there's a gun turret built into the jetpack with infinite ammo.
Yeah.
So if you can aim and fly at the same time, you're very powerful. So yeah. I think that probably will compensate for the fact that you are twice as big and twice as visible as anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't fly, the actual vertical launch of the jetpack in Killzone is not that high.
Yeah.
I mean, it's higher than a normal jump. It's probably three times higher than your normal jump, but then you can move laterally pretty far with it. Mm-hmm. And it even has a dash built in, I think.
Yep.
So it's not, I don't think it's going to break the level design or anything like that, but when you have it, it feels like you're powerful and you can go to all kinds of crazy places. It feels really good. Whereas in Reach, I felt like it felt like a super jump.
Yeah.
It's like, it just wasn't satisfying to use at all in Reach. I was very disappointed.
But yeah, I mean, Rico, fortunately, he's definitely been toned down. I mean, he's not dropping F-bombs and S-bombs like every second word.
Are you sure that's good?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's interesting because partially because of that, the story feels a bit blander this time around. I mean, granted, the story of Killzone as a series has never been high art.
What?
But there's no Rico just completely going off, I'm going to kill everybody, fuck you, shit. You know, there's nothing like that, at least so far.
There should be.
I think they knew that they were coming out the same week as Bulletstorm, or they knew that it would be close. And they're like, we're not going to outdo those guys. Why don't we take the high road here?
Yeah, I think they did.
Killzone must look positively refined next to Bulletstorm.
I'm sure it does.
Really.
I haven't played Bulletstorm.
It must look so high art and sophisticated in comparison.
But yeah, so I've only tried the campaign so far. I've not tried online, but it looks very similar to Killzone 2. You know, you have your classes. I think I'll see how I do online with the move controllers.
Will it show like a golden move controller next to your name?
I don't know. I was wondering the same thing. I was really wondering that. I don't know.
It should.
I don't know. We'll see. But and also because Johnny has talked it up so much, I decided to download Fluidity. And
yes.
I gotta say, I'm very, very impressed with it. I've made it through most of the first book. The only thing I haven't done yet, I'm at the point where I've got the exploding water, which is incredibly cool, and I'm at the point where I have to hop up in the cable car. So yeah, I mean, it's really, really inventive. I think the control schemes are brilliant, and I think the base concept of it just works. Like not even completing the goals, but just the act of actually playing the game is very satisfying.
I thought of that I beat Fluidity this week. I got all the rainbow drops and I beat the final level.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not really an ending, but my total time spent on it was over 24 hours. Now that includes, I had a friend over and he started his own file. He got about as far as you, maybe not as far.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of fudge there, but I mean, I play that game for over 20 hours and I got everything.
Yeah.
So it's an excellent value. And one thing I thought of the exact same thing this week as I was finishing it up. I was like, I think what I love about this game is it's fun just to move around.
Yep.
Like you can just fuck around. You don't have to accomplish anything, but because of the way you control it and because of the physics of the water, it's actually really interesting just to roam around and do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like just to get from one place to another is part of the challenge and part of the fun. And so, even if you're frustrated on a particular puzzle, and that's the other thing, like where you are right now, John, and where Billy is too, because I've talked to him about this some more. He's really not that far either. And the early part of the game, it starts a little slow because it's not linear because it has you going off in two or three different directions, but there's like only one thing at a time that you can do next.
Yeah.
And very close to where you are, I think the game starts to open up more and you have a lot of choices about where you can go and work on.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're frustrated with one thing, screw it. You can come back later, go off and do something else.
Yeah. It's also very rewarding though in the way that I think the pacing of it is really well done, where you kind of get to an area and you're like, man, you know, I really don't know what to do here, or I think I have to acquire something else or some other skill or something like that. And sure enough, there you go. You unlock something and you're like, that's exactly what I had to do. And the same thing, like I said, I just got the exploding water, and it's like that just opens up so many different things, and you kind of look at the game environment in a totally different way.
I don't want to overplay the similarities to Metroid, because I do think fluidity has a much different feel, and that can be a turnoff for some people. Like when Billy brought this up on Weekend Confirmed, the reaction from Garnet and Jeff Kanata was, oh, so there's a lot of backtracking? It's like, no, the structure of the game is actually very different from Metroid in that way. I mean, the way the levels are mapped out, you really don't have to do any backtracking. You can always go straight pretty much immediately to where you want to go to do the next puzzle. But one way it is because you get all these abilities and they let you go to new places. And, you know, I've talked before about how the best Metroid upgrades are the ones that actually change the way you move and the way that you play the game. So they're not just keys. They actually make Samus feel like almost a different character. And fluidity, almost every single ability in that game, and there's like 10 or 12 of them that you get over the course of the game, and almost every single one can be used everywhere at any time, and they will dramatically change the way that you move around the environment. Even very late in the game, the very last power that you get, you can go back to the very first level and complete a lot of those challenges in a completely different way now that you have that power.
Yeah, it's very open-ended.
Very, yeah. It's just incredible. And it's because a lot of these depend on physics. And so it just gives you the sandbox where the designers can give you all kinds of crazy tools and make sure that you don't break the game by using them.
Yeah, and it's criminally underrated. I mean, it blows away most retail releases on any platform that I've played in the past year. So highly recommended. I mean, again, I'm pretty much preaching to the choir, but
there's a free demo. Try it.
I mean, if you like puzzle games in any way, shape, or form, just buy it. It's really, really good. Actually, I've been playing a little bit of Wii. I'm trying to get my wife into Monster Hunter Tri. You know, that's the next part of the experiment, to try to get her into that. And, you know, because I'm trying to find some good co-op Wii games. And so I'm trying that and New Super Mario Brothers Wii.
Wait, can you play two-player on the same system with Tri?
Only in arena mode. I think online is only one player. But I just kind of took her through, like, the noob areas.
Hmm.
Just to kind of like get the feel of the game down and get the controls down, because actually the controls, I mean, it really helps when you have somebody there to kind of step you through all the controls and tell you why you're doing stuff. I mean, for Monster Hunter Tri, it's pretty much mandatory just because it uses every freaking button on the Class Controller Pro.
Yeah, the way items are handled is kind of weird.
I would go so far to say they're handled poorly.
Yeah, I mean, and that's exactly it. You know, people complain about the camera, but, you know, just the whole experience of trying to explain it to somebody else. The camera actually makes perfect sense when you realize that sometimes, like when you're running away from something, it makes perfect sense that they treat the camera the way it did. Because when you first play it, you're like, this camera sucks. This is terrible. But it makes perfect sense when you realize that you kind of have to get like a panoramic view of what's going on around you when you're running away from something. So really, it makes perfect sense that the camera is decoupled from the view of your character, because sometimes it's in your best interest to see what's going on behind you, what's going on to the side. So that's fine. But what's really difficult, and really what I think is still broken in their control scheme, is the fact that to use any item, you pretty much have to stop what you're doing and sit there and like gulp down a potion. While you're being chased by something, you just can't do it on the fly. And I think that's really what makes the game kind of artificially difficult. But also, it was interesting because, you know, as complicated as the control scheme for Monster Hunter Tri is, really, it's not really too difficult to get somebody acclimated to it. And I could see, you know, I could see somebody completely coming in that had never played it before. Actually, you know, after a little bit of coaching and everything, actually having fun playing that game.
Well, your wife probably doesn't have any expectation of how it would control, right?
Correct.
I mean, do you think that might be part of why she's finding it easy to pick up? Is that, you know, the whole dual joystick controller thing, she probably doesn't have much experience with that in the first place. So it's easier for her to just fit her mind to whatever the layout is.
She's not expecting to be able to lock on to something, for instance, yeah. Like very everyone else is.
Yeah, like it should do.
Yeah, you know, so yeah, she's sort of a blank slate in that regard. New Super Mario Brothers Wii, on the other hand, I have pretty much given up on that game.
Well, hold on. Before we get to that, I want to ask about Tri for a minute.
All right.
Well, James, you've been playing it recently, have you?
Yeah, so I got it a week ago today. And I guess on Saturday, after I actually got to start playing it, before Radiant Historia blew me up, I sent John an email going, John, hey, I don't know if you're still playing Tri, but let me know if you are, because I just got it and I'd like to try it online. So up to now, 5 days later, I am replyless.
Yeah, I saw that email, and I swear I replied to that.
Dude.
Maybe I have a draft going or something, but I did read that email.
I'm hurt.
Yeah.
And my hands out on my heart.
I have one draft in my inbox, and it is not responding to James. But I swear to God, I read that email, and perhaps I just had a really strong intent to reply to it.
Delete. I'm just expecting the standard Lindemann response of 2 weeks later, LOL.
But trust me, I will reply to it. But I figured I'll just see him online, you know, kind of, you know, we hook up and we hunt some monsters and it'd be good times. Come on, I mean, I'm just saying, I'm extending an invite to you to be my monster hunting buddy.
Oh, thank.
I'm extending the olive branch out to you.
I think actually technically James extended it and then you ignored it and now you're trying to...
There was no ignoring. I read the email. If only Gmail had read receipts. James would have gotten one. Maybe it wouldn't have been as personalized as I would have wanted.
If only Gmail had a reply button with which you could respond to emails.
Hey, you know, I've been busy, all right? I got stuff going on. Dog ate my homework.
Tell you what, James, I can't speak for John, but I'm hoping to rent Monster Hunter soon myself. And when I do, if you're still playing it, I will definitely play online.
Yeah,
okay, Johnny,
John.
Whatever. I mean, you know, try to be the good cop now.
I am the good cop. What you talking about?
So, John, the first boss in the game, it's like the T-Rex looking thing. It's the big version of those.
The Jaggy?
Yeah, the great Jaggy.
So I killed him. Yeah. Why didn't the game tell me that he'll just randomly spawn sometimes when you're in the middle of stuff out in the field now?
Yeah, well, that's the way it is now.
Yep.
So I'm just out in the middle of the field chilling out, and all of a sudden, boom! And that was the end of that adventure.
Yeah, he blows you up.
Like,
for sure.
Like, I got him one time because I had all the gear that the game gives you for a mission, and I depleted all of it. Didn't have that this time. And he ate my face.
Yep.
This game sounds delightful.
It's like literally, I'm just over there killing the little jaggies, like, yeah, bitches. Who's the boss now? Oh, God.
Boom. Dun, 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 dun,
dun, dun, dun. And he starts doing that high stepping, running away.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. You start doing the high step. Yeah, my wife got a big kick out of that. She was like, what is your guy doing? That is hilarious.
We need to move on. We're still technically on John's new business, although we've all been interjecting plenty.
Well, just one quick thing on New Super Mario Bros. Wii. I've decided that it's basically just like one of the cheapest games I've ever played. Playing it with two people co-op just makes it even less enjoyable. And I would say that I probably enjoy Super Ghouls and Ghosts much more, and I think it's actually much easier than New Super Mario Bros. Wii, just because Super Ghouls and
You're
Ghosts
crazy.
You will die a lot, But you will know exactly why you died, and you can change the way you play to get past parts.
I think playing New Super Mario Bros. Wii alone when I beat it was probably to my advantage.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to see you play Super Ghouls and Ghosts cooperatively.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, I'm not saying that. I mean, cooperative, just, I mean, that makes any game harder, but...
People would be killed. Man. I mean, they would literally be killed.
You sound like you need Kirby, John. Just admit it.
John, are you saying even in single player, you think Mario is harder than Super Ghouls and Ghosts?
Dude, that game is so fucking hard for me.
You're insane. Yeah, it's not even that hard, dude. Donkey Kong is a lot harder.
John, you are no past way. It. If you
are
so.
Insane.
There are a handful of levels.
You've lost in- your edge.
Maybe that's it. Maybe I have, but I just
I've played both of those games pretty close together, and come on.
I think New Super Mario Bros. Wii is so fucking cheap. I think that is a cheap fucking game. You will die. The thing is, the problem I have with it is that you will die 20 different ways. None of them will teach you anything. You are no better after you die 20 times.
And you still don't get the galaxy or the super guy.
Fucking terrible. I'll say it. I hate that game. I basically hate it. And that's why I haven't really played anymore. I think I'm in the third world, the ice world. And I just, every time I play that game, after 30 minutes, I'm like, I hate this game.
The third world's harder than Ghouls and Ghosts.
I will yeah, look. In John's defense, there are levels in that game that are cheap.
I agree. It's part of the reason that it's one of my least favorite Mario platformers. But it's not that hard.
I just don't find it rewarding to play at all. It's just fucking annoying.
I just found it boring. I felt like it was all stuff I'd done before. Like, other than co-op, I felt like every level in that game was basically just a remix of shit that I've done in other Mario games.
I agree with John, because, I mean, to me personally, I beat that game simply because it was mine. It's got to go down. But it was a comparatively joyless experience.
Yeah. I played through the DS game. I played the whole thing, and I thought it was really good.
Oh, that was piss easy, that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually with you there, John. I think in a number of ways, the DS game's actually... I think it's more fun, and it's a little bit tighter than the Wii game. I mean, it's easier, it's shorter, and it doesn't have the co-op. So the Wii game definitely has some upgrades, but I think it's less fun.
I don't know. I mean... It is what it is, and I think this is a greatly personal thing.
Just get Kirby, John. That's your level.
I guess so.
Point.
I mean, I guess.
Listen to Greg condescend. Oh God!
If you think the third level of if your skills have declined to the point.
I mean,
point.
Greg, if you're gonna sit here and throw down the gauntlet on this podcast, and I'm going back to that game. I'm playing. I'm fucking beating.
Greg's
it.
Wagging his finger at you.
If your skills have declined to the point you think the third world of a Mario game is harder than Ghouls and Ghosts.
Fuck me.
You can't make those throws back across your body into the middle of the field anymore, John. You've got to accept that.
Farm could never make those throws back across his body.
Brilliant. I thought I'd take a shot, Greg. I just thought I'd take a shot.
To be fair, 2 points. Firstly, John is not going back to that game. He is going back to the directorship temporarily to fire Greg after this experience.
You called face facts, John.
I'm invoking a clause buried deep within the directorship rules. When insulted by a British man on a podcast, I can temporarily return as director and fire
Martial
that
law.
Person.
It's reality.
Right, what I don't understand is how John Lindemann could play dozens and dozens and dozens of Super Mario games.
Thousands.
Literally
thousands.
And hasn't built up the skills to be better at New Super Mario.
He did build them up. They're just gone.
This is a public shaming of the highest order. So.
Oh, John, I'm so glad you're back. It's just build up from the past 2 weeks. We missed you so much.
It's on. New Super Mario Bros. Wii, it's on. I'm declaring it.
It's not. I don't want you to make yourself suffer, really.
Now, Greg, you got something to hold over me.
But for those of you who can't see my email inbox, i.e. everyone else, John has just tactfully responded to my...
Hey, man, I just felt it would be, you know... I just happened to be going randomly through my email inbox, and I saw your email there, and I thought I would respond to it. I thought it was the polite thing to do, James.
I can write emails and talk on a podcast simultaneously, which is pretty impressive.
Oh, that's okay. I can post on the Twitter feed and talk on the podcast, so we're good there.
Well, you're going to have to because it's your turn, James. Tell us about Radiant Historia, please.
All right, so Radiant Historia, we talked about it on the podcast a little while ago, kind of.
Yeah, but you hadn't actually played it.
No, none of us have played it. So Radiant Historia, if you're really out of the loop, is an RPG published by Atlas in the U.S. In it, you play as a member of the Alstelian military who goes by the name Stock. And at the very beginning of this game, he's forced to make a decision to be a member of the special forces in his country's current war with another state over arable land, which has been slowly shrinking, or to join the military to serve in that same war. At that point, the history of Stock splits into two separate timelines. And using this ancient book, he's able to jump between those two timelines to sort of influence the outcome and try to achieve the optimum result, which is to prevent the slow destruction of all arable lands on the continent. That's pretty much the game in a nutshell. So there's essentially two parallel stories going on. And in one instance, he's kind of working against the military. He's doing more covert things. And in the other, he's taking this position of almost becoming a national hero because of his achievements on the battlefield.
Now, what is the tone of this game like? Because you've talked about a lot of military stuff, but I mean, isn't this a fantasy Japanese RPG? There's obviously time travel, but do we have demons and dragons and stuff like that?
There are monsters, but they're not really... I mean, there are different races of monsters, and there's a couple races that actually are human-like. But generally speaking, most of the combatants are people. So at the moment of the game, there's two big states, and they're at war. And there's a third state that's kind of just profiting off the war from the other two. And the tone of the game is usually either the war's gone horribly wrong and you need to go back in time or go to the other timeline and fix it, or the war's gone really, really well and that's caused some other problem down the road. I mean, basically the game comes down to Stock does something, everything goes to shit. Stock goes back in time or goes to the other timeline to fix it, comes back, everything's better again. And then everything falls to shit a few minutes later.
Do the two timelines stay independent of each other?
Yep. So once they split, they're split. So really, he exists in both, and he's the only person who's conscious of both timelines. So pretty much all the characters are in both, but what your relationship with them is greatly different because of the decisions that have transpired down the timelines. So in one that I followed down, the outcome of the war or battle is completely different than in the other because of the stuff that's happened, mostly due to your actions, but how your actions have also influenced other people. But a lot of times what happens is you'll follow a timeline for a while and then you'll hit a dead end and it'll say, you know, you'll need something. You'll need to find someone. You'll need to learn a skill. And you'll get a hint from these two guardians of this book, the Radiant Historia. And they'll basically tell you, you need to be able to do this. Or you'll get a kind of a vague hint that tells you you need to go back to some point in either this timeline or in the other timeline to figure out what you need to do to keep going. So a lot of times you're either bouncing between them really rapidly or you're sticking to one and pushing down for a long time then jumping back to the other, which can prove to be kind of disorienting because there are two very separate stories going on and you might be out of one for 2 hours and then come back and be like, what the hell are we doing? I've totally forgot what we were up to. So you have to pull out the timeline that you're using to jump around on and kind of review the events that have happened up to this point. You can only go to certain points on that timeline, so there's lots of little events that are transpiring, but only the really big ones get these jump points. So you might have to relive part of the story again, but you can kind of skip through it. What's interesting is, at the very beginning of the game, so I'm pretty far into the story at this point. Both of my timelines are kind of moving to the same goal in a way. But a lot of the stuff early on, you'll see that a timeline point will branch. And maybe there's a note on there like, you met some guy, but he died. And the recognition is that you can go back later in the game and do something that changes that person's fate. And so I've spent before we started recording, I was just going back in time to all these little hanging timelines to try to piece them back together. Which in a way is kind of what's interesting about the game. A good example of how that comes into play is I found this character who lost his sword, basically. And later during a battle, he's killed because his replacement sword is crap. Well, further down in the game, you actually find it. So if you go back to when you first meet him, he'll recognize that you found his sword and take it from you, although I kind of wanted to keep it. And he doesn't die in the battle. So later on in the game, he's still alive. So you'll see him. If you go back and view parts of the game, he'll be there now. So whereas before, he was just dead and nobody saw him. Now he's there and he'll have input into the game, into the story, which is, it's kind of neat to see how these little things will trigger changes. In one case, I had a character who his weapon broke. So I went to the other timeline where I killed him and took his weapon from him and then went back to the first timeline and gave it to him as a replacement. So, I mean, there's lots of little things about moving around and shifting time, and it's kind of a neat way of doing puzzles, because as opposed to, you know, just like doing dungeon puzzles, the real puzzle is in figuring out how to move through the story. The actual dungeons, such as they are pretty straightforward. The battle system is kind of weird. It doesn't seem very complicated, but there's lots of little things you can do to not die.
Can you control time during battle?
No. So Stock can only go through time at save points, and he can only go to, essentially, events that cause those save points to be created. So if I wanted to, I could go back to the very start of the game right now. And I could, if I felt so moved, play the entire first timeline again right now.
Could you screw things up by going back in time? Is there any risk to doing that?
I don't believe there is.
So you can only improve?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, like, I've got a bunch of hanging loose ends. There's a character whom has asked me to assassinate one of the primary villains of the game. And I'm fairly confident that the game won't let me do that, because if it did, it would greatly destroy the story going forward. But I guess it's entirely possible that the game does intend for me to do that, and then it's going to affect the game somehow. So, periodically, I'll go back to that particular event and try to figure out, can I really do this? Is there something here for me to do? That's kind of what's interesting about it, because a lot of times you're seeing things, you're like, hey, what can I do now, you know, versus when I was here before? Is there something else I can do that I couldn't do 2 hours ago, 3 hours ago? Have I learned something that's helpful? And a lot of the skills you pick up through the course of the game, when you go back in time with them, are actually really helpful.
Now, Radiant Historia has gotten a lot of comparisons to Chrono Trigger, and obviously they share some kind of time travel theme, but how valid do you think that comparison is?
I think more than the fact they share this time travel theme is the impact that doing stuff has on the timeline going forward.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how this game has in terms of alternate endings and stuff. I assume there probably are, based on how many optional side quests there are. In that respect, it's similar. Obviously, Radiant Historia has the benefit of being, what, 15 years older? Or 15 years newer, rather?
Yeah.
It's not like Chrono Trigger in that there are a set number of distinct time periods, and events transpired there in the story, but you can go back to those time periods when you're done. These are fixed events, and if you go back in time to those events, all the characters that you encountered there, yourself excluded, obviously, are still living out the event that transpired when you were there last time.
Yeah, this sounds more like Slaughterhouse-5, kind of. I mean, you're going back in points in your own lifetime.
Right.
So it's not like Chrono Trigger, where you go back to 65 million years BC.
Yeah, so like when I go back in time to deal with a battle that went really poorly, and sometimes you'll be given a decision to make, and you can make the wrong decision, and then at the end you meet with these guardians of the book, and they're like, yeah, that wasn't the right call. We're going to send you back now. Don't screw it up this time. And you get to go make the other choice. I've gotten a lot of bad ends where it's like, and they lost the battle. And then they were overrun. And then he was ashamed of himself. It's like, okay, that was the wrong decision. Get to go back to the other one. So there's a lot of little just screwing around in the timeline that's kind of interesting. But there's also a little bit of frustration, because you are going back to your point in time. So you can't just at any point say, oh, I want to go to this village, because there might not be a timeline that takes you there right now. I mean, you may be able to get there if you go to another timeline and then that story leads you there, but it's not like just a warp system. You're really just moving the game backwards.
It seems like there could be a danger of the game becoming tedious if you're replaying certain encounters over and over again trying to get a different result, or if you're not sure what to do and you just have to kind of go back and experiment with a lot of different points in the timeline.
By and large, you can play the game pretty I don't want to say linearly because it's clearly not linear, but at the very least, even if they're just jumping between the two timelines, it's not linear. But yeah. I mean, the game will tell you when you've hit a dead end in one timeline. It'll explicitly say, you can't go forward. This is it. You're stuck here. You need to go to the other timeline and figure out what you can do.
But if the two timelines are independent, why would going to the other one be beneficial?
Because he can get things in the other timeline and take them back with him.
Like skills or items?
Like skills, items, just knowledge.
Oh, so there is a bit of like a light world, dark world kind of thing.
Yeah, a little bit. Also, stuff you do in one world can kind of affect the other one. So there's an incident where a character is an ally, but he has to be dealt with. And dealing with him a bit roughly in one timeline sort of changes his personality in the other, although he's not quite sure why. He's just like, I feel a little nervous around you, is basically how he starts treating it. And it's because you just beat the crap out of him. But by and large, it's a lot of, all right, I need to get this guy to move. And then you go to the other timeline because the game's giving you some kind of hint saying, you know, there's a guy who's really good at a skill that would help here that you could go, that you might know. And they'll describe a character you've met. And you're like, oh, I know what they're talking about. And then you just have to figure out where in the timeline to go so you can talk to this person. That's actually the more frustrating part because you may have 10 encounters with this character, but the game is explicitly wanting you to go to one of them. And you're like, all right, which one do I go to? And you're just basically pouring through the timeline so you find the right one, and then you go back, and it's basically a key, and just open the door. The game actually will skip boss battles if you go through the timeline again, which is good, because the boss battles in this game are criminally hard. But overall, I've had a lot of fun with the game. It's pretty long. I'm at 26, 27 hours, and I'm probably coming near a pretty linear end. I haven't done a lot of little sub-events on the side, but I've really enjoyed playing it, and it's a very well put together game. It's got very good presentation. The character sprites are pretty retro, but they're reasonably well animated and they're colorful. It's an Atlus game. It's not going to appeal to everybody, but it's a good Atlus game.
Yeah, it's kind of their niche. I mean, they seem to be doing that really well. They almost remind me of Working Designs back in the day.
Oh yeah.
You know, they're the ones that kind of bring over all of these RPGs and everything, and they always have the collector's versions of them with, like, which version did you get, James? Did you just get the game? I'm assuming you just got the...
No, I got the CD version.
Oh, sweet.
Don't they usually just release one version that has something like a CD in it?
I've gotten two Atlus review copies in the last year, and they both had CDs. Only in this game, I might actually listen to the CD because the other game's music was kind of shitty.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about the soundtrack to this. It's composed by Yoko Shimomura, who composed Super Mario RPG and some of the Mario Luigi stuff. That's what did Pedro write about that for us, I suppose, part of the Mario RPG feature.
Indeed. And Shimomura actually has a letter on the back of the disc thanking their mom and dad for making them who they are.
Nice.
But I actually really, like, I found myself, you know, bringing the game to play it when I have just a few minutes, whereas usually I would just pull out the phone and browse the internet. Because, I mean, I usually play handheld games at home, but I've been bringing it with me, so that's probably a good sign. I do think the timeline stuff, though, is helpful because it actually lets you compartmentalize play periods. So you can say, all right, I've only got a few minutes, but I'm at one of these points you can jump to in time, so I can go try to round out a subquest. And for a few minutes, and then save and call it a day. And I could just jump back to where I was.
Well, it sounds very interesting. I guess you're going to be reviewing Radiant Historia for us.
Yeah, hopefully by the time we record next week, it should be up. But,
okay.
You know,
great.
I mean, this game could have another 5 hours, 10 hours, or 50. I'm not sure.
Well, I'd be very curious to see what you have to say about it in the end, because it sounds like something I would like a lot. The problem is I'm probably not going to be able to get it right now.
And then you'll never be able to get it.
It'll be hard to track down later on when I have, you know, a little more money, but I might have to borrow your copy in a few months. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Bring it to PAX.
I planned on it.
Yeah, I'll fight everybody else for it.
I think Neil bought a copy, so he's okay.
All right, well, I'm up next, and I've been playing a Virtual Console game. So Let me do a quick poll. How many of you have played Fasanadu before?
Well, you know I have, because I spoke about the Japanese Virtual Console release several months ago now.
I've made fun of it. Does that count?
So, John, no for you?
I like the box art, but...
Yeah. Oh, it is cool.
I've never played the game.
It is cool box art. So, Greg, yeah, I remembered you saying something about it. I couldn't remember if you'd actually played it or if you just observed that it was out.
No, but... I bought it, played it.
Been there, done that, bought the t-shirt.
It's back in October, I think, last year. It came out pretty soon afterwards in Europe, so I have no idea why it's taken this long to make it to America.
Yeah, I don't know either. We were kind of hoping to get it, you know, towards the end of 2010, but I'm very glad it's out. I mean, I had good memories of this. I vague memories of playing it as a child, but good memories. I think we had just rented it from a, you know, from some local shop. So I hadn't played a lot of it, but, and I probably didn't get that far, but, you know, it had left a good impression on me. And so now I own my own digital copy of Fasanadu, or Faxanadu, as everybody else is calling it. And, I do really like it. I still enjoy it quite a bit, although I can't imagine, Greg, you must have been constantly referencing a guide to play through this in Japanese. This is not import friendly. I mean, this game is obtuse. I'm having to go to a guide for a couple of things, even in English, because
well, that's
the game
kind of
is...
what I'd heard, that it was that kind of game, so I thought, well, what have you got to lose?
Yeah,
you're going to be going to a guide anyway.
That's a good point. Yeah, I mean, it's not Castlevania 2, it's not Zelda 2 in terms of being just inscrutable. But it's the kind of thing where if I had infinite time and patience, I could probably figure out the whole game on my own. But I get to a point where I've spent an hour running around, not really sure what to do next, and okay, I'm going to go check the guide because I paid $5 for this game and I got other things to do. And I like it. I want to get farther. I want to do more. I don't want to keep, you know, banging my head against this one part. So I have gone to a guide a few times, but Fasanadu is actually really good, I do think. I mean, despite some archaic 8-bit design elements, I mean, it is basically an adventure RPG style action game from, you know, the late 80s. So, like Zelda 2, it has moments where it's just not very clear what's going on or what you should do next. But, you know, in general, it does play very much like Zelda 2. Very similar in a lot of ways. There's a few differences here and there. It's in some ways more like an RPG, in some ways less like an RPG. I think the combat is unfortunately not as interesting as in Zelda 2 because you can't crouch.
Yeah.
So there's none of the high-low shield usage, stuff like that. You have a shield, but it just blocks certain kinds of shots. That's all
now,
it does.
It is a side-scrolling platformer, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Although it doesn't actually scroll. It's screen.
It's a side paging.
Okay.
Yeah, which I guess technically Zelda 2 does scroll, but Zelda 2 had black backgrounds and, you know, Fasanadu is more sophisticated. It's a later game. It's doing a lot more on a technical level. It's just better presented. It's less glitchy. So, I think in general it's still very challenging, but I think it's less brutally difficult than Zelda 2 for sure. It's more playable. It's easier to understand because the translation is much better. It's not perfect. There's still some weird and unintentionally funny lines in the game, but, it's pretty clear what people are saying, and you don't have any crazy stuff like I am error, you know.
The classic.
So, yeah, I mean, the people in the towns actually tell you things that are useful sometimes.
Damn it!
They give you clues as to what you need to do next, but there's still some sort of trial and error figuring things out, too. And my main issue with, mechanically, my main problem isn't with the combat or anything like that. It's just that it's this key system that it uses.
Oh, you have to buy the keys. Even for doors you've already opened, you have to rebuy the keys.
It's a Dragon Quest 1 system where you buy keys and they're single use. Once you use them, they disappear. And if you ever need to go through that door again, you're going to have to buy another key to use it there.
What happened in video games that keys broke instantly?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a Japanese thing, I think. And there's several different kinds of keys, and it's possible to buy too many of one and then not be able to sell it back to the later stores. So you end up with, like, crappy keys that you don't need anymore, and they're filling up inventory slots. That's something
God's
I'm dealing
sake.
With right now. Yeah, there's some stuff like that that's a little bit nutty. But overall, the game is very fun to play. It's very interesting. The level design's interesting. The monsters are challenging for the most part. They're very simple. Most of them just kind of run at you, but they move in different ways. Some of them jump, some of them fly, etc. Some of them shoot projectiles, some of them don't. But when you see a new monster, it's always kind of interesting to figure out its pattern and figure out how to kill it, which is a very 8-bit type approach to combat, you know. And some of the boss enemies are definitely difficult. Potentially frustrating, I think, but usually the level's designed in such a way that there's a certain place you can stand and kind of slowly whittle away at it or something like that. And you do have an inventory where you can store potions, you know, to heal you up, so you can use those at the right time. You have magic that's pretty powerful, but you can only refill your magic power when you go to a town, so you kind of have to be judicious about when you use that. And the level up system, and this is one of the things that I would have a lot of trouble understanding if I wasn't playing this in English, but the level up system is basically you gain experience, and once you get up to a certain amount of experience, you go talk to a guru who's kind of like a save person. You know, he's in a church in the town. You go talk to him, and he gives you a title. So your title will be like warrior or swordsman or lord or whatever. And the title basically entitles you to restart from that point with a certain amount of experience and gold. And the guy will give you a password too, which you don't need on Virtual Console, because if you die, you just go back to him. And you can always suspend it when you're done playing. So you don't need to write down passwords. But the way titles work is like, it makes it so that money is never a major issue.
Yeah, because you always start off with that endowment to begin.
Exactly. And the more experience you gain, the higher your title gets, the more money you are given when you die. So there are some cases where you could even die on purpose to gain more money than you currently have, which is kind of silly. But because of that, things like having to buy keys that are consumable, it's not really that big of a deal because you always have money. You can always get money very easily, so buying keys really isn't a big deal. So I'd say the graphics are actually really nice. The problem is they're very brown and green. Yeah. The game takes place in a tree, and you're sort of slowly climbing this tree. There's multiple towns throughout different sections of the tree. There's dungeons and enemies all over the place. So the entire game is within this giant world tree, which is really cool. It's a great idea, but everything's brown. So the visual style of the game...
So it's next gen is what you're telling me.
It lacks pizzazz, yes. But the music's really good. The graphics are nice despite
the
limited color palette.
For mature players such as myself.
and the game is a nice challenge without being crazy difficult or anything like that. So I like Fasanadu quite a bit. I'd say if you like Zelda 2, or if you wish you like Zelda 2, like if you kind of like the idea of Zelda 2, but you don't really like the execution of it, you'll probably like this better. Next up, I would love if somebody could release Battle for Olympus. I don't know if it's legally really out there on the table, but it's one of the very few other Zelda 2 style games. I guess EES3 technically is kind of like Zelda 2. It's a side-scrolling adventure RPG, but EES3 has kind of been shunned by the fans of that series.
Well, yeah, that's not surprising, I'll be honest.
The creators actually remade it to be more like EES 1 and 2.
Nice.
Yeah, even the guys who made it aren't really big fans of EES 3, which is too bad. I've always thought it was really cool. I'd like to play it again, but it seems unlikely. So the next best thing is, I think, Battle for Olympus, which I played as a kid and loved. I would love to see that. It's, again, very much like Zelda 2, but sort of more advanced. Came out later, has better graphics. Who knows? But I'm glad Fasanadu is finally here, and I am recommending it for sure. And the only other game I've played all the way through this week, I have been playing some Dead Space 2, but I think I'll probably talk about that next week because I'll probably have finished it by then. And there's some interesting Nintendo tie-ins with Dead Space 2 that I'll get into later. But I rented Crackdown 2 and actually played through it, the whole game, in one weekend because it didn't take terribly long. And Crackdown 2, you know, it came out last summer. I was looking forward to it until the reviews hit. And I was planning to buy it until all the reviews came out. And the reviews were really down on this game.
Well, they basically said it's the same game, but they made no improvements.
Yeah. And quite frankly, that is true. I cannot disagree with that at all. It is basically Crackdown 1 with the number 2 on it. It is. Unless you're going to play it four-player co-op online, which seems very unlikely at this point.
Or at any point, really.
Yeah, basically. I mean, I'm sure that was a lot of effort to get that working and to make sure the game didn't completely break when you have four people in it. But that's a feature that I feel like so few people are really going to make use of that. And it's pretty clear that that's the only place that the developers put any kind of innovation and, you know, serious creative effort into, because the rest of the game is a complete recycling of the first Crackdown. Now, with that said, I had a great time playing it because I love the first Crackdown. So for me, the experience was almost exactly like if I put the original Crackdown back into my Xbox and just started a new game and played that. It was almost exactly the same experience. But that I would have fun if I did that, you know, and I did. So I'm not going to say I didn't enjoy Crackdown 2, but I definitely see where the reviews are coming for, because even like really simple mechanical stuff like the lock-on system, that seems like that'd be the first thing that you would fix if you're going to make a sequel to Crackdown. It's exactly the same. It might actually be slightly worse in Crackdown 2. Yeah, and then some of the things that they did add, you know, they made it so that if you get the highest level or the second highest level of agility, you know, by collecting all the agility orbs that are stashed up on rooftops, which is the best part of the game, they made it to where, and they had announced this ahead of time, if you get up to a certain level of agility, you unlock the wingsuit, which sounds awesome. You know, like it lets you control your descent, it lets you glide around the world. And in this kind of open world game, that could be really interesting, and it could help you get to other things that you would like to do. So I was really excited to do that, and I was going to get a bunch of agility orbs anyway, because that's my favorite part of the game. So I did that, you know, I spent like 2 days, several hours of gameplay, collecting tons and tons of agility orbs, and I finally unlocked the wingsuit. It's terrible. It's not fun to use at all. I mean,
yes!
It's a horrible addition. It's not fun whatsoever to use the wingsuit.
Is it just not play right?
It basically makes you fall slightly slower, and it lets you control your fall more.
So it's a crappy parachute.
The thing about
basically.
Crackdown is it's the whole game is about going up, up, up. It's not or maybe across, you know? Like, it'd be nice if you could glide from one building to the next, from one rooftop to the next.
Yeah, because there's a lot of go up, 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 and then slowly down, then back up.
Yeah, and instead what the wingsuit does is it gives you so little control that you would only really be able to use it much at all if you jumped off a skyscraper, which in that case, you know,
you're going to die when you get to the bottom anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it takes so much effort to get to the top of a skyscraper in the first place. You don't really need a wingsuit to get anywhere else from that point.
No.
I don't know. I found it very disappointing. It's still also really hard to upgrade your driving skill, which I was surprised by, because that was a major imbalance in the first game. I was, like, maxed out on everything, and then my driving was, like, halfway built up.
Yeah, you had to be amazingly good at driving, but the cars themselves handled like shit.
Yeah.
Because you were bad at driving.
Yeah, so in Crackdown 2, they add these freaks, which are basically zombies that come out at night. And it's funny because they turn, if you're in a car, that game turns into Carmageddon. Because the streets are just filled with droves of freaks. And you can drive, you can plow through them with any of the vehicles, and you'll get orbs for doing that. And I thought, oh, that's great. They've solved the driving issue by just letting you drive around and plow over these zombies and get tons of driving orbs that way.
They fixed it through mass murder is what you're telling me.
Yeah, but they didn't really fix it. It's just they basically rebalanced it so that those are worth so little that you still don't level up from it. So
great.
It's weird. It's so strange. It's like, you know, I understand it wasn't exactly the same development team. It was a separate company. They had some of the same people working on it that did the first one, but some not. And I understand that maybe there's some spin-up time to relearn how you made the first one and to develop your own tools and everything. But it's like they worked on this game for like 3 years, and it seems like they spent that entire time just recreating what they did for the first game.
Because the first one was done by Real Time Worlds, right?
Right.
Who later
shit out APB.
Yeah, the whole APB debacle.
Super successful APB.
Took them under.
And Crackdown 2 is made by Ruffian Games, who were, I think, about approximately 50% ex guys who worked on the first Crackdown.
Right.
So the sad thing is, the legacy of Crackdown is that one great developer who made it a great game split into two shitty developers who made two shitty games.
Yeah.
Crackdown 2 is not shitty, but it has no reason to exist. If you're interested in Crackdown 2, just play Crackdown 1 again. you'll have fun either way, but if you already own Crackdown 1, you won't spend any money.
Or if you don't own Crackdown 1, you'll spend less money because Crackdown 1's cheaper.
So, Greg, please wrap up this epic new business.
Yeah, well, first of all, it was something I wanted to say. We had last week's listener question from Jeff in Nottingham going on about sort of European exclusive DS games or whatever, things that he could pick up now that he's here in Britain. And there was a suggestion that I forgot to mention explicitly because he mentioned that if in lieu of a legitimately good game, he would accept a batshit insane one. And that reminded me that Rising Star Games here localized the DS port of Suda51's Flower Sun Rain.
Oh, fuck.
So I don't think that's meant to be legitimately good.
No, it's terrible.
I can only assume it's pretty crazy.
Nick hated it. He's like, this game is unplayable.
On the off chance that you can locate a copy of that, perhaps that will sate your appetite for madness. So, yeah, I just wanted to mention that. But I've also got, for my new business this week, quite an obscure game. This is Soul Bubbles from 2008 for the DS.
I've always heard great things about Soul Bubbles, and it was a previous Retroactive nominee, actually.
Yeah, it got good critical reception, but of course, especially in America, its impact was going to be limited because it was a Toys R Us exclusive. So I guess there was immediately not a lot of faith that it could move a lot of copies, and so they took all the money they could from a exclusivity deal. But the weird thing is, I actually, because it came out in 2008, there's always been good reviews for it, and I actually placed an order for this game more than a year ago. And it was one of those situations online where you see something for a good price, you place the order, they say it's in stock, and then a bit later you get an email that says actually it's not in stock, we'll send you a copy when we get another shipment in. So nice. Nearly a whole year passes, and then a couple of weeks ago, out of the blue, it gets shipped. I opened up the package, and there it is, Soul Bubbles. Oh, that's nice, because I haven't seen a copy of this available new for quite a while at this point. But then I realised something odd. The case was surprisingly slim. And wait a minute, isn't that an E for everyone? And oh, it's Toys R Us exclusive. They sent me a US copy of the game.
Nice.
Which I'm not even sure if that's really proper conduct for a retailer to be sending me a secret import game. Certainly they won't be getting away with that with 3DS stuff in the future.
Oh.
So that was really weird, just showing up out of the blue like that, an import game. But I'm pleased that it has come into my possession, because I've been enjoying this quite a lot. So if you don't know the premise of the game, basically it's a touch control driven game. It's really the sort of thing that you might have thought would be quite a lot more common on DS if you sort of got into DS like I did with Canvas Curse. You know, if that sort of set your mind going about what the possibilities were going to be for sort of touch-driven games in the future, this is the sort of thing you might have imagined but didn't really get very much of. So in this, each stage is 2D. The environments are kind of sprite, drawn, but you've got like a polygonal character, polygonal enemies and things like that. And then the actual bubble itself bubbles that you'll be controlling, they're polygonal because they have physics, which are really quite satisfying, very well executed physics actually. But the main premise is you start a level, you have these like spirits that you have to shepherd to a goal at the end, you draw a bubble around them, and then you use your character to blow in various directions to guide this bubble to where it needs to go.
It's like those stages in Galaxy, right?
It is a little bit. I mean, but with the way it works with the touch control is, so if you tap anywhere on the screen, your character will sort of warp to that point. And then if you drag from your character towards the bubble, it'll then blow the air towards it and put it in the direction you want to go. So that's the basic mechanic, and that plays pretty well. And for the first, it's got like, I think, 8 worlds in total. And for the first 2 or 3 of those, it's not too complicated. You just kind of, you're guiding it through these passageways, and there's some obstacles, but it's very relaxing. The aesthetic, the music, everything about it's got a very pleasant sort of vibe to it. And you're just collecting stuff as you go, and there's not much going on really. But as it goes on, each world then introduces like quite a substantial, unique gameplay wrinkle. So, for instance, you'll have one world where you could draw a bubble around like a kind of a flower or fruit, combine it with the bubble containing the spirits, and then it can actually shoot projectiles at enemies and stuff. And there's another one where you've got like different kinds of gases, where you have to draw bubbles around like either like gas that's very heavy that weighs the bubble down, or very light that causes it to float up, and eventually you mix the two to create a sort of explosive bubble, and you get some quite advanced puzzles involving those sort of mechanics, especially if you try to find like this. There's just getting to the end with spirits intact, but then there's finding these secret items that tend to be, you know, quite well hidden, and sometimes have the more advanced kind of stuff that you have to do to get them. You have to collect enough of those over the course of the many levels to access the very final world. And so someone could see a lot of the game if they might find those bits challenging. They could see a lot of the game without having to tackle that and then maybe go back to it. Or if someone like me are quite happy to just do it as I go, because as I said, it's in general, it's not difficult at all, but it is entertaining. And so my only sort of quibble with it really is just that sometimes when you add these layers of intricacy on top of the core gameplay, it does make the interface a little less elegant than it seemed in the beginning. For instance, when you're shooting something using your bubble, when you've combined it with those fruits, you have to trace a line out from the center of the bubble. But it's very easy, if you just miss it a little bit, that it registers it as a tap. And so all it does is move your character to the point that you tapped. So once you introduce these things on top, it pushes it a little more in terms of how tight the recognition has to be and all that. So it exposes some little flaws there, but nothing severe, I would say. You know, it still plays really well, and it's really refreshing at that point in the sort of really in the second half of the game that you do get all these different, you know, the really substantially different gameplay feel, especially I think the penultimate world, which is based in, you know, an ice location. The bubbles are frozen, and so they're very heavy. And in fact, it plays very fast. You're sort of guiding these bubbles buzzing around tunnels. It's almost like something out of Sonic or something. It's completely different to the very languid pace of the rest of the game. So that kind of variety is really cool. So it's kind of a shame that this sank without a trace, because it's, you know, the kind of thing that really, you know, is very tailored to the DS and, you know, not something that you've played an awful lot of. I mean, it has this like faux health warning screen at the beginning, which says like, warning, this game does not contain licensed racing cars, post-apocalyptic soldiers, gangs, you know, like all this stuff. But it's going to be all right. You can still have fun. You know, it's quite charming. It's a sort of game. So I'm glad to have finally got my hands on it. And, I'm sure there must be some way to get hold of a copy still. Maybe it has to be eBay at this point. I don't know.
Yeah, I definitely want to play Soul Bubbles. Definitely. I've wanted to for a while, and I've never gone through the effort of actually trying to acquire a copy. I don't remember what it was up against. I was sort of hoping it would do better in retroactive, but I think it's just so poorly known that nobody voted for it, you know?
Yeah, it's tough.
It does definitely seem worth another look. I'm glad you got it, Greg.
I think it's a horribly named game.
Yeah, like, bad.
You really have no idea what it's about, or
it's the mermaid version of Soul Train.
it's tough to know how to package something like this.
Yeah, and I mean, retailer exclusive, as we've seen many times, like that Chibi Robo Park Patrol that was a Walmart exclusive. I mean, just
Walmart, yeah.
Stuff like that. I remember in the N64, there were a lot of games that were Blockbuster exclusives. You could only rent them from a specific store. It's like such a kiss of death.
Yeah.
Daikatana. Well, that had its own kiss of death, though, so.
Was Daikatana a rental exclusive?
It was a Blockbuster rental exclusive, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think luckily, in the age of digital distribution, retailer exclusives make no sense anymore. Because you're probably going to reach a much wider audience by going to digital, and then you can make up the difference on what you save in volume, in manufacturing costs, and, you know, et cetera.
Also, you'll reach an audience that's more receptive to that game.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's just, it's really sad. I mean, I was just thinking, like, I wonder if Soul Bubbles would be a candidate for something like 3DS-ware. You know, we don't really know anything about 3DSware yet, and I guess we probably won't until May.
I don't know how big the game is, but I mean, full DS games have been re-released on DSiWare in the past.
Yeah, it depends on, you know, certain cuts were made in certain cases, but you would hope, you know, and you would certainly hope and expect that 3DSware has a much more lenient file size.
You would hope
so. Yeah, but I would love if some of these more obscure DS games actually were able to be easily repackaged and redistributed through 3DSware. I think that would be a wonderful use of that service, in addition to original titles, of course. Okay, well, that's going to wrap up new business, and so now it's definitely time for a break. We need it, and when we come back, we'll have your listener mail, so stay tuned. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a feature. It's called Looking Back, First Memories of the DS. We kick off this series of memories with Pedro, Josh, and Carl sharing their early experiences with the handheld Juggernaut. We also have a preview of Kingdom Hearts 3D Dream Drop Distance.
Horrible. Awful name.
Yeah.
That's three Ds, by the way. Dream Drop Distance.
That's terrible.
I thought those horrible names ended with the 64.
No, because we had Resident Evil Deadly Silence.
Yeah, so anyway, Pedro tells us all about what we can expect from the upcoming continuation of Square Enix's beloved Kingdom Hearts series.
All right, and we also have a review for Da Blob 2 on Wii. Neil lets us know whether or not jumping is still mapped to the Wii Remote, and check out his review to find out what the sequel does differently. And also, on the blog front, we got High Voltage Shows Off the Conduit 2 soundboard from Neil.
Wow.
Hit the link that Neil provides to make Michael Ford say naughty things over and over and over and over. And he is sounding, I must say, Michael Ford is sounding very Duke Nukem on that soundboard.
Yeah. Oh, great. So I guess they just gave up.
Yeah, I mean, they might as well just have had him saying, come get some.
Balls of steel.
Get over here. It's the redneck scorpion.
Our next review is of Dragon Quest VI, Realms of Revelation for DS from Nathan. Does the final entry in the Zenithian trilogy of Dragon Quest titles set itself apart from the rest? How is it for new players? Nathan tells all. And in blogs, we have a look at some Club Nintendo rewards. First of all, Johnny MacGyvers a suede pouch into a Kindle holder, and Zach put some Kirby patches on his backpack so he can brag about them in lunchroom. Read these blogs and see them for yourself.
You see, I love Greg because he just reads what I write.
What can I say? As you command Megatron.
It just goes more smoothly that way, doesn't it?
It depends on what John wrote, doesn't it? Alright, so Pedro has the latest Extra Life for Vegas Stakes, in which he tells us about the SNES game that isn't high on the list of favorites for most kids growing up.
Is that the one from HAL?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
It's surprisingly fun.
I never played it.
I know, it sounds weird, but I liked it too when I was a kid.
Neil has the totally unnecessary review of Rock Band Country Track Pack 2.
Two.
It's a mini review.
In case one wasn't enough.
Finally, another one.
Yeah. Noting that it is probably the shortest review in the site's history.
Yeah.
And it tells you whether or not this collection is worth it for owners of the original Rock Band game.
Alright, be sure to check out all this great original content each and every day over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Hi everyone, it's time for listener mail. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And we've been getting tons of great emails lately. I don't know how many of these we're going to get through. We're trying to keep up with it, but quite frankly, we can't keep up with it because we've got so many. So I'm sorry if your letter doesn't get read. We might get to it at a later date. And if not, write us again, because it's not because we hate you. We're a little overwhelmed, actually, with the amount of awesome emails that we're getting. So, John, I think you have the first one.
T Tensor Hunter writes, I really enjoyed the RFN livecast, especially when Craig Harris was a guest. Is there any chance of him making another guest appearance? It's always nice to hear from a gamer who's nearly as old as me. With the 3DS eShop opening up in May, what are the chances of Nintendo increasing the file size limit for 3DSware games? If so, would that give Super Meat Boy another possible release avenue?
Wait, so John doesn't count?
Yeah, I think John and Craig are roughly the same age.
Yeah,
actually.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know exactly how old he is. I would have to... he may be a little bit older than me, but probably not much.
Yeah, I think you guys are pretty close, actually. Mm-hmm. I would love to have Craig back. It seemed like he had a good time. I don't talk to Craig that often, but I know how to get in touch with him. And I would definitely like to get him back on soon. So when we feel like there's an occasion to do so, we will try to do that. You know, it's tough, though, because we don't have outside guests very often. When we do have guests, they're often, other staff members because they're easier to work with. The problem with outside guests is we are imposing on them a lot to get them to do the show because we have to ask them to install a bunch of software and show up at a certain time and yada, 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 because we're not going to move our schedule around for guests. We can't. Our schedule is very inflexible, and so if people are going to come on the show, it really has to be on our terms, and that makes it a lot harder to do, even when people would like to do it.
And that's not really the way stuff gets booked in the industry. It's not, hey, you'll come when we say you come.
Right.
That's kind of backwards.
For practicality, that's pretty much the only option that we have.
Right.
Anyway, enough meta discussion. As for the 3DS eShop, I guess the question here is actually about the file size limit for 3DSware, which we don't know anything about.
Well, they can't increase it because they haven't said it yet.
Right. Yep. It has to be bigger than DSiWare. I don't even know exactly what the limit is for DSiWare, but it's small. And 3DSware has to be bigger. It has to be.
I mean, Nintendo might not have even really made the call yet either. I mean, still some way out until this thing launches.
Yeah, there is no 3DSware announced at all. There's not a single title that I can think of that's actually been announced.
There's been some hints from some developers that they're working on stuff, and there's been some explicitly saying, I'm working on a title for 3DS that is not a retail release. Mm-hmm. But they won't say, I'm working on 3DSware.
Yeah, I'm sure My Notebook 3D will come out in various colors.
I will trash it in the downloads article. Yeah. I've reached the point where Germans aren't allowed to release fireplaces and Australians can't release stationery.
You'll show them, James. They'll rue the day that they release shitty non-games.
We needed My Notebook 3D 10. Fuck you. Words aren't 3D.
I wonder if Team Meat would be interested in doing a handheld version. It seems like that could possibly be a lot of extra coding work. You know, if 3DS is very different from the other versions that they've done.
I mean, it could, but the thing is, though, it could also be a very different version, though. Like, they could actually do something different with it rather than just straight porting.
Right. I mean, they could try to work the 3D in, but given the difficulty curve of the game, it might make things... I don't want to play a Super Ghouls and Ghosts in 3D.
Hey, because there's nothing wrong with that. I don't want to play a new Super Mario Bros. Wii in 3D, for that matter.
I do want that. I actually went back to Super Meat Boy this week and played more of it on XBLA, and Super Meat Boy is amazing. I'm fully behind any plans to do anything else with that game because it's awesome. Mm-hmm. So I really hope that Nintendo gamers will be able to play it on any platform.
It would be really good for a portable though, because it's really a good bite-sized game. I mean, perfect.
Absolutely. Yeah, dude, that game, the target times for most of those levels are under 10 seconds.
Yep.
Of course, you might spend 3 hours trying to actually finish it in any amount of time.
There is some hope in this because I know there have been some game engines that have gone from Wii to 3DS pretty easily. And at some point, they had a Wii Super Meat Boy engine. Mm-hmm. So the work's kind of done, depending on how easy it is to move your engine over.
They got it. Obviously, the version that they had for WiiWare, it wasn't a million miles away from the limit of 40 megabytes. They got it down to like 50 or something and just could not get it any lower.
Right.
So if the file size limit on 3DS is just a bit bigger, which it certainly has reason to be from the perspective that every 3DS ships with a 2 gigabyte SD card.
Upgradable too.
Which is upgradable versus every Wii shipping with, 512 of internal flash, and the DSi was what, 256? It was half of that.
Yep.
So, I mean, there's every reason to think the file size limit could be considerably bigger, even though it doesn't really have to be all that much bigger for Meat Boy to potentially come over.
And and not just that, they could actually make it smaller on DSiWare because the
resolution.
Yep, they could squeeze it down probably a little bit more. But it really, I think, it just comes down to, do they feel like making another port of this game? And they might not. They may feel
certainly
like...
Certainly people feel like porting Cave Story.
Yeah, but that's a retail release.
that is going to be a retail.
That's a boxed release, I mean.
Cave Story's 3D is a weird situation.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a complete rebuild.
But only graphically.
But I mean, it is a new build of the game. This probably
sure,
wouldn't
I get
be.
That. I think it'll be good. And I love Cave Story. But I've already played Cave Story. You know, I mean, it's not like they're releasing it to a different audience. I think they're releasing it to the same audience.
I disagree. I think maybe they're releasing it to people who didn't downloadware, Nintendoware, as we refer to it collectively.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's going to be a high-end game in terms of pricing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. When I get a 3DS, I will definitely consider Cave Story 3D, but I'd like to see that they're adding some new content to it, you know, some bonus features or something. For me, because I've already played Cave Story.
It'll be amusing because you'll be able to download the DSiWare version of it on the same system.
Yeah, that's true. So it really needs to be a lot better, you know. It's going to cost considerably more than $10, which is the DSiWare price.
Which is really high for DSiWare.
It is, yeah. So they really need to make sure that it's worth it. And I've already paid $12 for it in WiiWare. So I like Cave Story, but I don't need to buy it three times.
I've said that about many game. I don't need to buy this a third time. Usually it's to Capcom, and usually they still got my money.
I bet a lot of people are going to buy Ocarina of Time for at least the third time. That's what the 3D stands for.
Third dipping.
Yeah, third dipping. That's good. Okay, James, you have the next letter.
120 writes, I was just wondering what you think the chances might be, or rather if there's any chance other than zero, that Nintendo's launching of the eShop in the 3DS in May might coincide with a complete revamp, or rather scrapping, of the Wii Shop channel, freshly branded eShop as well. It seems as though the Shop channel is a great outlet that Nintendo could use to help keep Wii alive during the year's game drought, but whether or not they do that would be a completely different story. I know that not having the eShop available on day one allows them to tinker with it until it's perfected, but it seems conspicuous.
I don't know that delaying it until May has anything to do with a Wii remake, but I do think it's a good idea, badly needed on the Wii.
Yeah,
they could certainly relaunch that without the 3DS having to launch theirs at the same time.
Yeah, they could have done that last year.
Yeah, I think that was surely the time for that was some time
before
ago.
Before they started releasing second fireplaces and third aquariums?
For instance, you could have had perhaps a more substantial overhaul to the interface, to the layouts and whatnot when WiiWare came about, you know,
they just added another button.
WiiWare didn't come along until 2008, you know, so the system had been out for quite a while. But as you said, they just grafted on another little bit to the store and so forth. So it doesn't seem likely to me that they would use it as a chance to wipe the slate clean with all the download services.
I was more surprised they didn't do something more distinct with DSiWare, because the DSi shop is not good.
Yeah, and Iwata's actually been talking about the eShop and saying that they've learned a lot of lessons from, especially the DSi shop.
The DSi shop is conspicuously worse than the Wii shop.
Yeah.
And especially on a handheld, it needs to facilitate quick impulse buying.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the reason they rebranded it instead of the 3DS shop, which is horrible. eShop is, it kind of sounds like something you'd call for quick transaction purchases.
Yeah.
It's got that kind of, this is technology name to it, too. So you just like go in, buy something, get out.
Well, and the nice thing about the eShop is it does get away from the platform-specific designation. So it is a brand that they can develop and then take it to their new console. I like the idea of taking eShop to the current console with Wii, but I just think if you look at what Nintendo has done, or more importantly, what they haven't done with the Wii Shop channel over the past few years, it seems very unlikely that they give a shit enough to actually completely overhaul that thing. Although we can all agree they need to. It'd be great if they did.
It would be a very large undertaking for possibly very little reward.
Yeah, it just seems like the whole Wii Shop channel was like a proof of concept.
I think the DSi Shop channel was what? proof that that was a bad plan.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I look at what Nintendo has done, kind of the same way that like how Sony, like how PSN and everything, that was so awful at first.
Still pretty bad, dude.
Yeah, it's still, I mean, I'm not saying it's great, but compare that to, you know, the Xbox. I mean, people think Xbox Live is just the way it's always been on, you know, on 360. I mean, you know, they had a very, they had a large head start to get Xbox Live to where it is mm-hmm. today. You know, it takes a long time to develop something
like
that.
They had the blades and...
They've rebuilt the live interface 3.5 times now.
Yeah.
I mean...
Well, but the great thing about Microsoft is they're willing to do that, whereas Nintendo's like, nope, this is the way we made it.
It's perfect.
That is true.
We can't change it now. It's too late. And of course, it's not too late. But for whatever reason, they just seem really reticent to actually go back and fix their mistakes. But as far as eShop being delayed until May... I don't know why that's the case. I think it's completely insane. And it's going to result in me canceling my pre-order for 3DS.
I mean, I know why it is. It's as I said before it was even announced, Nintendo can't get through a launch without doing something where you go, what the hell?
It's just not ready. I mean, it's the only explanation. It's just not ready. And then you have to choose between two unpleasant options. Do you know, ship it with some sort of... prototype version of the eShop on there, some sort of skeleton version which you'll fix later, or do you just wait until, you know, you've got it ready and they say they want to do it right this time, and then, you know, hopefully it's going to be good at the end of it. But
they were supposed to launch this system last year.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, they've just missed all sorts of targets, clearly, for whatever reason.
Yeah, I think the fact that it wasn't ready is the more pressing thing. I mean, this is not something that you start at the last minute.
Mm-hmm. It's weird. It's very weird.
The fact of the matter is, in many ways, you know, if the timing were different, they might have been willing to delay the whole thing a little longer. But as we know, it's the issue of getting the launch out within the fiscal year. That's the only reason.
If it was like 2 weeks, we'll hold off. But if it's 3 months, nah, screw it. We're going.
Yeah. And I mean, some people might think I'm crazy for saying I'm going to cancel my pre-order because of the eShop being delayed. But the thing is, I'm not really interested in any of the retail launch titles.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe Pilot Wings, maybe Steel Diver, but not really that much. So for me, the main thing would be getting to download all these DSiWare games that I don't have access to right now, and getting like the Virtual Console handheld stuff. Link's Awakening would satisfy me for a few weeks, you know, like that would be fine. That would get me through the launch window until more interesting stuff came out. But if that's not available on day one, I don't need the system on day one.
Well, I have similar sympathies, although there is an issue right now where, like, in Europe, in the UK, there's a kind of retail price war going on with 3DS because there was no recommended price. Everyone's sort of bidding to undercut each other. So it seems like, you know, you're not going to get it cheaper after this, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And maybe there'll be shortages. We talked about that before. So I have a pre-order. Maybe I'll cancel it because I feel similarly to you. But on the other hand, you know, I could just buy the system and put it in a safety deposit box for a couple of months or something. But the one thing that I think speaks to the unpreparedness of Nintendo is how poorly they manage the information about this topic. That we had the utterly remarkable situation where, first of all, they're just completely non-specific. Then we get people from Nintendo of Europe saying in interviews, "This, oh no, it's going to be ready on day one. It's just going to be a day one patch, basically." And then Nintendo of America are asked about this, and they're like, "Well, we're not going to say anything specific about that." And then a few days after that, Iwata is giving a presentation in Japan in which it's explicit that it is not going to be on day one and it's going to be in May. I mean, it's just absolutely astonishing to me that the level of incompetence and lack of information sharing. And the thing is, that sort of thing has ripple effects, because then you get, you know, IGN puts together an article about All Stuff 3DS and someone sources their information from the eShop from the wrong source, and then it perpetuates the misinformation again, and everyone gets their hopes up, and then it's quickly dashed, and it's just a mess that's mm-hmm. entirely of their own creation.
It wasn't just anybody, wasn't it? Like Laurent Fisher, who screwed this up?
I think it, yeah, the
partly, yeah,
the man under, not the head, that's Shibata.
No, he's the head of marketing.
But he's the head of marketing, so it's, you know, his job.
He should freaking know.
He should be on top of the messaging.
Oh, they're not going to market the eShop anyway.
But I just think it betrays how rusty. This is a sprint to the finish here, to get to the fiscal year. That is all they're dealing with.
Isn't it weird? They're not trying to get it out ahead of a competitor. They're trying to get it out ahead of an arbitrary corporate deadline. It's an accounting thing.
It's not even about how much money they make in aggregate over the system's life cycle or anything like that. It's literally just, what can we shunt into this period of time so we can hold it up to the investors and say, well, we did this for you this year. That's how much it is, but just about the balance sheet.
Sometimes making the investors upset temporarily is in their best interests. And by and large, investors forget that sometimes, and it it causes problems.
Okay, so the next email's from Danny, who writes, I want to firstly say that I've just recently started listening to your podcast because one of my friends converted me, and I love your work, great job, and I laugh and agree with a lot of your discussions. Anyways, I have two questions. Firstly, I've been hearing a lot of great things about Donkey Kong Country Returns, and so I actually obtained the first one, Donkey Kong Country for Game Boy Color. And that's not the first one, but sort of. And I'm amazed at how much trouble I'm having in the game. I get frustrated a lot, but I keep trudging because the game is good yet very challenging. I really want to play Returns,
yeah, John.
And I feel a relief of maybe easier gameplay. Can you compare the two, and is it as hard or easier or harder? Because I'm definitely considering buying DKC Returns. Lastly, I am a fan of arcade fighters like Super Street Fighter 4 and Marvel vs. Capcom 3. What are all your opinions of MVC 3 and Super Street Fighter 4 3D on 3DS? So first off, thank you to Danny's friend who turned him on to the podcast. We love word of mouth, and we really appreciate people who tell their friends about the show. DKC Returns, I kind of feel like I want to ask you guys, because I feel like I've talked too much about...
Well, I mean, the problem is I've never played DKC on Game Boy Color. So,
right.
I'm not comparing like with like here. But, I mean, I talked about some of the issues that I can imagine would be in play here when I discussed Donkey Kong Country 3 on the Virtual Console, in that one of the issues that really raises its head a lot in the old DKC games with that chunky art style is that things will just come very quickly. And it's difficult to see it coming a lot. And actually, what you have to rely on a lot of the time to anticipate hazards is the banana trails that are left scattered around. Now, yeah. I can only imagine that that problem is much worse on the low-res kind of compressed version of Game Boy Color. So, yeah, that may be a lot of the kind of difficulty that Danny's experiencing here.
Somebody wrote about that game recently for the site. I can't remember who
it might have been. Donkey Kong Land, which is a different thing.
Oh, okay. It might have been
similar issues involved, but they are different games.
Donkey Kong Land is like it's kind of a down port of DKC for the black and white Game Boy.
Yes.
So it's basically an attempt to make the same game, except they had to chop certain things out because of the technical limits.
See, I had forgotten about Donkey Kong Country on the Game Boy Color. I was actually thinking about Land. I had forgotten they even made this game.
So it was remade for Game Boy Color and then remade again for Game Boy Advance.
Yes.
And then they did 2 and 3 on GBA as well.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they got re-released a lot because they were, it was really successful.
They were popular games.
Yes, it was huge, so they wanted to keep spinning off from that. But, I mean, the point that I would make is with DKC Returns, it is very difficult, but I would say it's difficult in different ways in that, because it's, a widescreen polygonal Wii game with a dynamic camera. A lot of the ways in which it's challenging is not because you're sort of looking at this very small viewfinder and stuff. I mean, there's still issues about anticipating all the hazards. There's times where something's probably going to catch you out the first time you play it, and there's not much you could do, and so you're going to have to learn from your mistakes or whatever. But I don't think it's frustrating in the same way, even though it is difficult and certainly can be frustrating.
Yeah, I don't really think Returns is a particularly frustrating game. I think it's very challenging.
There are parts of it that can be frustrating.
I never really found it to be super frustrating.
Not inordinately so. No, as I said, I think it's less frustrating than the old games because it's less about like, well, you know, I just can't see that far, you know, like because of this graphic style. That is some, and it, you know, they do play, especially certain sections of old DKC games do play pretty fast, despite the fact that your visibility is so limited.
Well, I mean, that game invented the minecart level on Super Nintendo, so it's very fast.
And just watching the Game Boy Color game in action right now, I can see where some of this frustration would come in, because it's very, very choppy. It's kind of hard to really see what's going on.
It sounds like you might like Returns more. You might find it actually to be a little bit easier to play.
Well, and my feeling is that the DKC Returns is a better designed game than any of the old ones.
I agree with that.
So, I mean, just in terms of quality, rather than this specific issue of challenge, I think you're pretty safe.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, I'd say it's only about twice as difficult as Super Ghouls and Ghosts.
That joke just went...
Yeah,
I guess so. I wasn't even going to dignify it with a response. It's like, I don't even really know how to respond to it.
Have any of us played Marvel vs. Capcom very much?
I have not.
Not three.
I haven't played really any of the MVC games. So yeah. I like Marvel characters within reason. I'm not like
you played
a big
Tatsunoko versus Capcom.
Yeah, exactly. I like Tatsunoko. And the cool thing about MVC3, as opposed to the older games of that series, is that it does the same thing as Tatsunoko in terms of streamlining it to a 3-button attack system. Yeah. So rather than like light, medium, heavy punches and kicks, it's just light, medium, and heavy attacks. Right. So that fits on the current set of joy pads a lot better, you know, than having to use the shoulder buttons for heavy kicks and stuff. Mm. So I like the fact that that's carried over from Tatsunoko, and it seems like we've got a lot of cool characters. They're obviously, you know, it's a lot more mainstream and less bizarre than some of the stuff in Tatsunoko. But on both, I mean, Capcom stuff in Tatsunoko versus Capcom is at times, I mean, one of them is from a Japanese quiz game.
Yes.
You know, it's just utterly confounded.
There's still some really obscure, weird characters in MVC3.
I mean, there is greater quantity to go with it. But, you know, right. I mean, you've got Hagger, you've got Arthur, you know, these are the kind of the Capcom guys that I played with back in the 16-bit era, so it resonates a lot more with me. But then you have also got Clover stuff like Beautiful Joe and Amaterasu, so there's a great range there.
So the lineup is awesome.
I am definitely interested in this. I'm not necessarily going to go pick it out early in the process, you know, when it still costs a lot, but eventually I think this is going to happen, and maybe it will get a 3DS version before it's all said and done.
Yeah,
because I mean, it's the same. They use the same engine for MVC3 that they use for Street Fighter. So if that could be translated, then so could MVC3. And you know, we're already seeing that this big rush for fighters. You know, you've got Street Fighter and Dead or Alive at launch. You've got Blaze Blue coming.
Yep.
Maybe market conditions, you know, how the market responds to these games will dictate whether we get an MVC3 on 3DS.
I'm tentative on MVC3. I'm actually really excited for Street Fighter 4 3D for some reason I can't quantify. I think it's probably all Ono's fault.
Too many folded up Blanka figurines.
It's probably that you, like me, you want fighting games to be more fun than they actually are.
Oh, exactly right, John. You're exactly right.
I think it goes back to when I used to actually be good at those games, and then now when I play them and I'm clearly not. It's almost personally upsetting. But I go back to, like, in my mind, I'm nostalgizing when I used to be good in my circle of friends. I was never good on the Street Fighter 2 competitive circuit scale. But I didn't know that existed. I only knew that I could beat the living crap out of everybody I knew. So in my mind, I was really damn good.
It's all relative, isn't it?
Yeah, and since the great arcade purge had already happened here pretty early, I never had the opportunity to find out that I'm not a badass. I am not at all badass. And I think it almost tarnished those games for me when I realized, oh God, I'm actually kind of bad at this.
I went in the other direction. I think I was never good at these games, but anything after Smash Brothers, I don't think I even really want to improve at fighting games anymore. It's like, no, I can have fun with a fighting game while being knowingly rubbish at it.
Yeah.
And that's fine. You know, and even Smash Brothers obviously really works in that way because it's it's like almost, you know, like a sandbox. It's the comedy game, whatever. But other fighting games, especially something more like a versus game with crazy supers and the mashup and the, you know, you can enjoy it on that level without being very good at it. So,
right. And I think,
you know, I'm very comfortable with that notion at this point.
What makes me interested is both Tecmo Koei and Capcom decided to release major fighting games on the handle at the same time, but both of them put in some content for people who are new to the series. And I mean, Capcom's Street Fighter game has those quick combo buttons at the bottom, and Tecmo Koei has a very similar thing on the bottom.
Well,
screen.
I mean, to be fair, that is something that's happened already on DS. Like the Treasure Bleach games have that feature in them on the touchscreen for super moves. They're going from an established playbook.
You remember SNK versus Capcom EO, which had the version where you basically just mash buttons to win the game?
It's very not Street Fighter-ish. I mean, Street Fighter is all about, you know, the memorizing these combos and knowing...
Well, yeah, but I mean, you have to admit, even Street Fighter 4 in itself, so always, I mean, I don't have intimate experience of this directly, but it always seemed to me like that in itself, Street Fighter 4, was a big attempt to make it more accessible from where it got with, like, Street Fighter 3 or the Alphas or stuff. You know, they were kind of trying to bring Street Fighter back, you know, obviously towards Street Fighter 2, and maybe even closer to stuff like the versus games.
They wanted to step back from the precipice they had walked to, but I mean, it was still really complicated fighters.
Yeah.
I think they're going for approachable yet deep, which Smash Brothers wins for me.
I do feel like, though, that these 3DS iterations of these games are designed to be more approachable than their counterparts.
Well, it makes sense from the point of view that, as we've said, you know, with like Pilot Wings and launch and stuff, like launch games on systems, people will buy them that in under different circumstances they would not be so inclined to do so.
Yep.
Because it's like, Johnny's kind of alluded to it too, there's not the obvious like desirable games, but if you're buying a system then you want something to play for it. And so if you can make it accessible to these people who wouldn't normally have bought it, then maybe you can actually convert them and then actually have a repeat customer down the life cycle of the hardware. So, you know, I mean, it makes plenty of commercial sense.
Well, especially in a fighting game, you know, if someone likes it, they're going to try to convince their friends to buy it too, so they can play against each other. So you want to make a good first impression so you get those word of mouth sales.
Yep.
Especially on a
handheld.
And,
you know, when, I guess it was last week, Konami announced the release date for their Layton clone.
Oh, the Dr. Lautrec, is it?
Yeah.
Have you heard there's a new... are you Namco? Namco's getting in on the act now?
Oh, for God's sake.
It's crazy.
So what is Namco's? Is it like PhD candidate Lighten?
I wish I could remember the specifics now. It's actually for DS, not 3DS.
What's amusing about Lautrec, though, is that he is a doctor of archaeology, damn it, not a professor. Like, they didn't even try. He could have been a doctor of anything.
Just to wrap up the fighting game discussion, it sounds like John and I are probably on the same page, which is don't get fooled again. Because the characters in Marvel vs. Capcom 3 are so enticing to me. I love those characters. I grew up with Marvel Comics. I love Capcom characters. It looks amazingly fun.
Johnny, I mean, it has Nathan Spencer in it. How could you not want it?
Yeah, trust me, after my experience with Tatsunoko, I would be very disappointed in actually playing that game, because I don't actually find fighting games to be all that much fun.
Yeah.
That's the sad thing. Like, I want Marvel vs. Capcom to be a platformer or an RPG or something. Like, I want that to be a different kind of game, and I'm the first one in line to buy it. But it's a 2D fighting game. It's a genre that I have great respect for and do not find fun at all. Not
anymore.
It's
just they've become way too technical and just...
Well, and you've got to be able to play with, I think, for me anyway, online, it doesn't really appeal to me a great deal. You've got to be able to play with someone in the same room.
Yeah,
and,
very
you know,
much.
Repeatedly.
And that's not
going
to happen
so
for
you
me.
Get that, you know, you get that kind of rivalry going, even if it's not like fierce or anything, it could be entirely comical. It could be based on who's more inept. But, you know, need that sort of repeat interaction that you get these little kind of gags that build up. You know, if you don't have that for whatever reason, your circle of friends, your leisure time configuration, whatever, then I struggle to see how it would be worth what a purchase.
Exactly. Okay, Greg, can you grace us with the next email?
Ryan from Houston, Texas writes, "The upcoming release of the 3DS has made me think back to Nintendo's first portable. I received my Game Boy in 1989 for Christmas and played with it so much that I wore out the buttons and had to buy another original green screen model. Over 2 years later, I received my first pair of eyeglasses. I never thought the two were connected until about 10 years ago, when I pulled my old Game Boy out of storage and tried to play Super Mario Land. It was nearly impossible. Anytime Mario would move, the whole screen would turn into one huge blur. My point is that when I was a kid, my love of portable gaming allowed me to put up with a terribly eye-straining screen, even to the point of possibly damaging my eyesight. But there's no way I could do that now. If the 3D screen technology in the 3DS ends up being equally eye-straining and the typical user ends up turning 3D off, has the 3DS failed?"
First off, eye strain is not the same as myopia. And I know this because I dealt with this a lot as a child. As a myopic preteen boy who played a lot of video games, I put up with a lot of shit from my parents saying that video games were the cause, reading late at night in low light levels was bad for my eyesight, and it's not. It can wear out your eyes. It can make your eyes twitchy and tired and red and irritated. It can make you not sleep well. I mean, eye strain is a serious thing, and it takes a while to get over it. I've had eye drops. I've gone to the doctor. I'm especially in college. You can imagine being an engineering student. You get some pretty severe eye strain.
Yes.
And I've been to the eye doctor for eye strain. I can tell you it is a serious condition, usually temporary. It is unrelated to the prescription of your eyeglasses or contact lenses. You cannot make your vision worse by wearing out your eyes. They're two different things, okay? So I'm just telling you, I know it seems like they would be correlated. There's a lot of research, because I looked up this research as a child, and there's a lot of research that says playing video games are not bad for your eyes in the long term. In the short term, it can be very uncomfortable. You should take a break. But in the long term, reading books, playing games, etc., do not give you bad eyesight.
What it can do at worst is make it difficult to focus on other stuff at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just because the eyes are just like any other muscle. They do get tired. And if they're constantly having to make adjustments, eventually they're going to pass out.
With that said, I think it's funny comparing the original Game Boy so-called green screen to 3DS in terms of eye strain. I don't think it's the same phenomenon. It's a different kind of strain. The 3DS is actually, in my experience, and it's been a while since I played it. It's been last June was the last time I got to play it. I found it to be more of a mental strain than a physical eye strain. To use the 3D effect. I think there probably is some eye strain as well, but for me it was just such a weird experience that I found it kind of mentally exhausting more than physically exhausting. But I haven't played it for the long term. Nobody really has at this point.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we're recording on the eve of the 3DS launch in Japan, and yeah. I think some people already got their units in Hong Kong or something. So we expect to hear reports coming in pretty soon about all this sort of stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's a valid question, as I've sort of raised before, from the point of view that the 3D is optional, but you're paying for it. So if you don't end up using it very much because it affects your eyesight or for any other reason, you're not getting what you paid for. And from that point of view, will it have failed? Well, that depends on how one defines success and failure. I mean, you could still have ultimately, you know, a very successful system with a big library of very well-made games that doesn't actually end up using the 3D all that much, maybe because developers don't end up plundering its depths for great game ideas, but they just make good games out of the slide pad. We've talked about all the other features of the 3DS before.
It's
so,
like, the 3D is more important now, isn't it? Because that's the defining characteristic now.
Yeah, it's,
whereas
it's the entry
in 2
point.
Years you could buy a 3DS and probably be happy with it. Never use the 3D effect ever, because you'll have this huge library of games, all this other stuff it can do. You know, you'll have all this downloadable crap you can get, and you can use it like just a gaming system. You won't care about 3D. But for now, there aren't a lot of games to play on it. There's not a whole lot of interesting creative ideas being put out there in the software. Most of the hardware features aren't really supported by anything yet. The eShop isn't even launching until May. The 3D has to interest you or you wouldn't buy it at launch.
Yeah, and you know, if someone pays a price to pre-order the system, being sold on the 3D, and then after a sort of short introductory period finds they're not using it very much, the actual 3D part, that might sour them on the whole experience and maybe make them less inclined to buy more games for it, even when things pick up, you know, beyond the launch window, getting towards the holiday or whatever. So, I mean, yeah, they could be a problem in that regard. But the issue we have is, as you said, it's just kind of unprecedented. We don't know what this is going to be like when, you know, it gets out into the wild, you know, how it affects people over longer periods of time, you know, how many people can't even actually see the 3D effect. It's a bit of an unknown.
John, any comments on eye strain?
Just that I have extremely bad eyes, but I'm not really worried about the 3D. That's the thing. I mean, I still have yet to even get my hands on a 3DS.
That's right. You still haven't got a chance.
I still have not played one.
You know what? I'm really worried after seeing the booth layouts at PAX. That's not going to change.
Yeah.
That's very
because Nintendo has got to be the dumbest company in the history of the world.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll just have a giant tent outside, like a revival tent outside of PAX East, where that's where all their giant 3DS thing is.
In the cold of Boston, March.
I mean, I would hope that they would at least have something like some sort of trailer, you know, where you can go in and play stuff.
Peep show.
No.
Even maybe now, across the UK, you know, they're having tour events. You know, they're going to different shopping malls up and down the country, and people could come and look. I mean, you know, surely they must be doing something analogous in the US. And you just take the roadshow to PAX East. It doesn't even have to be something special.
They do such a better job in the UK of this. And it's partially because the country is more compact. You can drive across it in a reasonable amount of time.
I remember the GameCube, they had the bus, didn't they? I mean, they did stuff.
Yeah, they had the street team, didn't they?
Oh, the street team.
They had the Cube Clubs, which I drove over 2 hours from school in Auburn to Atlanta.
Yeah.
I think I probably met up with you, John. Probably went to the Varsity and got a burger.
Yep.
Of course, I mean, when you live in Alabama, you're used to going to outside the state to go see things like that. But
I mean, let's put it this way. They promised there would be, you know, extensive showing of the system, and they haven't announced anything.
Well, I mean, on the issue of marketing, at this point where we are this close, and it's not just in Japan at this point, you've got commercials over here. I assume there must be something in the US. I can't say
I haven't seen anything.
There's stuff on the Nintendo channel. I think you can at least preview the commercial. I don't have cable, so I never know.
We talked about this back when they first discussed, you know, 3DS, and then, of course, when everyone went to E3 and they saw it, and it's like, oh, it's great, but the problem is you've got to see it to understand what makes it unique.
And they've been pulling the trigger really late for years. Do you remember when Wii first came out? We're all concerned, like, they don't seem to really be marketing the Wii, and I don't think they started showing commercials for it till like 2 weeks before it came out. It was really late.
It's not so much the timing. I mean, you can coordinate these things pretty effectively, you know, especially with the amount of money that they've got, a sort of late blitz. But just the actual content of the commercials that I've seen in Japan and Europe, from what I've seen, is following the Japan playbook very closely. As we've said, you know, you've had all this time to think about what creative marketing wizardry can you use to, you know, sell people on something that you can't demonstrate what makes it special on a TV screen. The answer to that, which is just show people looking into a 3DS and going, ooh, is just the worst answer.
And that, they're doing that in America, too. They're up on Nintendo Channel. You can watch them. They're the same shit. It's like white rooms, white people looking at screens that we can't see.
Look, I'm not going to tell you how they could have made it better, but I refuse to accept that they couldn't have made it better. I think it's dire. there is nothing enticing to me about someone feigning amazement looking into, you know, a not especially sexy bit of portable hardware.
Yeah, at least do like a secret camera thing where you bring in like real people and get candid camera reactions to looking at the screen and then get them to sign a release form. That would be more interesting than watching actors fake it.
Did anybody here watch the 3DS event from Japan, the live stream?
No.
No.
So I remember watching that and a few other staffers I was communicating with while we were watching it. And between the they had those stage shows, and between them they had these videos of Japanese celebrities getting their first chance to see
I've seen some of these on the Nintendo
channel. They are awful. I mean, they are...
They are terrible.
They're irredeemable.
But that's Japan, I mean...
But, apparently it's the same shit they're doing here.
Exactly. I mean, yeah, maybe that works there. I don't know. But I'm not feeling it at all.
They're irredeemably terrible.
You would think with all the... Yeah, they got plenty of plaudits for the marketing job they did on Wii, and justifiably so. I think, you know, not without some missteps, but broad strategic view.
Outside of Metroid, they did a nice job with it.
Yeah, that's one such example. I mean, but broadly, they did very well. And that was not the easiest nut to crack, I would say. Not the kind of fundamental challenge that you've got here, but it was not easy, but they managed it. This just strikes me as, you know, if they have actually spent a lot of money to come up with these campaigns, they have wasted it.
Well, to be fair, though, the Japanese ones had two celebrities in the commercial at the same time, so that was where all the money went.
The scary thing is that Nintendo is going to set a precedent. They're going to choose how all games will be marketed for this thing, including third party, because the other companies will imitate them. And if you've seen the trailer for We Dare.
Oh, God, I knew you were going to crowbar this in somewhere.
Sorry. I mean, this We Dare trailer, it's not a trailer. It's totally out of the Nintendo Wii playbook. It's a video of people playing Wii, except they're playing We Dare, which I can't begin to describe. You have to go see it.
This is day zero of the viral We Dare infection that's obviously going to sweep the internet.
It's We Play Booty Edition.
That is a... There's a European commercial, and they've stuck with that format a lot more closely than even in the US. You know, like, for instance, with the US, they started to veer off, like, Mario Kart with some weird guy.
Yeah, I kind of like that one, actually. There's a whole series of them.
But the point is, they were deviating away from the living room and a bunch of people goofing around. Yeah.
Or the weirdo Japanese magic guys showing up at your door and saying, hey, we want to invade your home and hide your wife, hide your kids, and play video games with us.
That would not have gone down so well in the 80s, would it? All the paranoia.
No, I do remember watching that ad the first time. Don't let them open the briefcase!
Okay, well, it is certainly going to be interesting. Did we completely get away from that email? Well, sort of.
We went sideways hardcore.
Yeah, also, I wonder about... You know, going back and looking at your old original Game Boy and seeing it, I mean, it is a blurry screen. I wonder if that screen might actually degrade over time, if it might actually be worse than it was when you first played it in the late 80s, early 90s.
I would guess not, but I'm not super familiar with how those work. But I would think they maintain their relative unsharpness.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the good thing is, at least it's not inherent in the game itself. It was just the screen. So if you play those old black and white Game Boy games on a newer screen, they look much better. Much better.
Unless you're playing them on your GameCube hooked up to your 42-inch TV.
Okay, well, that's going to wrap it up, actually, for this week. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. We do have a lot of emails that we didn't get to, but
again,
we'll try again next time. It's going to be an ongoing fight. You can make our struggle even worse by sending your letters to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com.
Don't do that.
And apparently some people, the address doesn't sink in, apparently, for some people. So let me say again, it's R as in radio, F as in free, N as in Nintendo, @nintendoworldreport.com. Please send us emails. We'd love to see them. All right, so that is the end of the show. Before we go, I want to give a few reminders. First off, we're only like a couple of weeks away from PAX East. It's kind of scary. We should start planning this thing.
Yeah, we kind of should.
No planning.
I have ideas in my head. I just need to put them down.
I vote we do it live.
The entire thing will be held inside Johnny's head, actually.
Yeah.
You're just going to sit there and stare blankly out into the crowd.
No, I do have some cool ideas. We're going to have a lot of people there. We're going to have a really good time. So I hope some of you at least will be able to join us in Boston for PAX East. The panel Saturday morning, March 12th at 10:30 a.m. in the Cat Theater. We are super psyched. I guess, some douchebags from Penny Arcade are like drawing a comic or something at the same time, but Why would you want to see that? I don't know. Just, you can look at it later on the internet. So,
they're just going to draw a Dick Wolf again anyways or whatever.
Pretty much.
The guy that created Law and Order?
can I go to that then? If that's what they're drawing?
No, James, you are obligated to be on our panel. Sorry. So, yeah, we're really going to have a great time there. I can't wait. And yes, to answer everyone's questions that we get repeatedly, we will be recording it. We're going to try to videotape it as, not tape it, but we're going to try to video it as well. And I am not making any promises, but we may try to live stream it, audio.
Oh, dear God.
So if you're around that morning and you want to get it as fresh as possible, there's a lot of technical issues with that. It depends entirely on how good the internet access is, and we may not know until the last minute. So I don't know that we'll be able to do that, but we're going to look into it. I think it would be cool if RFN Live was actually live for some people at home.
Don't come to Boston.
No, well, if you're coming to Boston, you probably already know. But, I mean, I think the show's probably sold out by now. Surely it is. But anyway, we are excited. We will record it. It will go up on the podcast. You're not going to miss it. But if you're actually there, then you get to, you know, interact with us, ask us questions. We'll meet up after and, you know, hang out. So it'll be really cool. You can check us out, keep up with us on Facebook, of course. It's facebook.com/RadioFreeNintendo. Have a lot of fans over there, and we're posting stuff all week long. It's really fun. I just joined Twitter. Yeah, I don't only post video game stuff, but if sometimes I do. So if you want to follow me, I'm at Johnny Metz.
Do you post your drinking habits?
No, I don't do that.
Damn it!
Not regularly. I don't really have habits.
You mean hourly?
But actually, now James, you're sort of on Twitter, right?
No, John Lindemann is.
I'm all over Twitter.
John, what's your Twitter name, John?
My Twitter name is NWR_Lindy.
And what's your other Twitter?
Oh, real.
It's just John Lindemann, isn't
real,
it?
Real John Lindemann.
It's just at John Lindemann. Oh, so shockingly, that wasn't taken. We refer to it as the real John Lindemann.
It's shockingly not taken.
Sort of like the real Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Well, we would have assumed you took it, to be honest.
That's more James's Twitter account, actually, is the real John Lindemann. But
it's the two-headed monster of James and Carly arguing with itself like Gollum by the moonlit.
Pretty much.
We haven't done that since December.
Now, Greg, you're still pure, right?
What kind of question is that?
If by pure you mean still entirely...
He means chaste, Greg.
If you mean still entirely uninteresting for 26 years running, then yes.
Yeah, you're not on Twitter.
No.
Okay, thank you everyone for listening. We'll see you next time right here on the podcast for free. Bye.
Later.
Bye. Bye-bye.
I kind of understand what John's talking about, though, trying to explain how it is to teach someone how to play the game, except I don't have that right now. It's just me, and there are times where I want to turn to the person that's not there and go, what the fuck's going on right now? Because it's like, okay, now what game?
Are you teaching yourself, then?
Yeah.
When I think about you, I teach myself.
Nice.
Why did that pop into my head?
It's not gone well so far. So the first, much like this episode.
Do you know the expression I had on my face then was like Yoda when he senses all the other Jedi dying at once? If I had a cane, it would have hit the floor. That joke was so terrible.
Oh, that is pretty bad. That is a new abstraction point from which we can judge all bad humor. Oh,
sorry. Oh, you're not on Twitter.
No.
Okay.
You're not even on Facebook, are you? Are you?
I don't really exist. I'm a brain in a jar.
Right. Yeah.
Oh.
If you're a brain in a jar, how does one slob your knob?
They don't, because that's...
Maybe I could graduate from being in a jar to being in a sort of Krang style mech. Nice.
Yeah, yeah.
But does it have to be bald? I mean, his was. Yeah, no offense, John.
If you're gonna build a robotic body for yourself, make it look good. Is that what you're saying?
Oh yeah.
Why was his bald and wearing that?
Why did he look like a thug out of The Dark Knight Returns? That's what I want to know.
It's awful.
Yeah, you got that? Okay.
You know what? I'm impressed because when I was like 5, that was my first thought. I was like, why does it look like that? He built it.
Maybe it's fashionable in Dimension X or whatever it is.
Oh. Yeah. Dimension X. Oh, man. The memories. Okay. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Sweet masochism.